Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. I learned how to swim, really swim, as an adult. At that point in my life, I was already comfortable in the water. By that point in my life, I had already worked actually for a number of seasons as a whitewater canoe and kayak instructor and guide. I'd spent lots of time in the water, including in the water in difficult circumstances. Not necessarily, you know, let's go for a paddle when it's calm kind of circumstances. But if you had said to me at that point in my life, hey, let's swim from the dock to that island over there, I would have been like, no problem, just let me get my life jacket. Because I knew that I wouldn't get far without it. So when a lifeguarding instructor that I knew offered to trade me swimming lessons for kayak lessons, I went for it. I figured this matches my budget, which is zero. And also, you know, he's going to get something that he wants and needs, and the mutuality of it appealed to me. And he taught me how to swim. And in a typical case of, you know, A-type personality overcompensation, I kept at it until I got a certification that would allow me to work as a lifeguard as well. I'm still not a fast swimmer. The fish in our family is Kareen, but I'm way, way better than I was. And that whole learning trajectory might be the reason why when I was learning how to swim, I felt this sense of immediate affection for what are sometimes called resting strokes. Some of you know what I'm talking about. When I first started, one of the problems that I had was that I was basically thrashing around trying not to drown because I didn't know how to both make forward progress in the water and to breathe in the air that I needed to keep going at the same time. Those, in my experience, were mutually exclusive processes. I could stay afloat or I could breathe, but I couldn't do both. And so resting strokes sort of felt like swimming salvation to me. You know, like they at least eventually, but not at first. At first, they felt like an oxymoron. Resting and strokes, as I said, were, in my experience, mutually incompatible, right? It took a fair bit of painful practice, including an in-water exercise called chicken wings. If you know, you know. If you don't, I can show you later. But it took me a fair bit of just suffering and getting water when I wanted air and needed air to teach me otherwise. Now I believe, because I know by experience as well as in theory, that you can both move forward in the water and rest, at least in relative terms. But that's not where it started. What I want to do today is I want to offer some exploration of something that's a little bit akin to those resting strokes, metaphorically. For some of us, perhaps those who already have some comfort or experience with what I'm going to describe today, these ideas might feel like a relief, like a bit of a breath in. They might feel like ideas that support notions or lived realities that we've already encountered, that give some language to those or some framework to those, some shape, sort of like swimming strokes, if you will. Having said that, for those who feel like they're barely staying afloat in this wider exploration of religious trauma, these ideas might feel otherwise. And I want to acknowledge that as well. So, as always, what I want to do is offer this for your consideration and not for your heedless consumption. I know that my saying, please don't swallow things whole in this setting, does not mean that that's how they go in. That's not up to me in the end. But I'm going to keep saying it because it's what I can do to prevent, or at least help perhaps contribute to preventing that from being the way we take things in.
I don't think it's a good idea to swallow anybody's ideas without giving them a good chew first. What I would encourage you to do, if you're able, is watch for, be open to what might be here for you. Some of these are going to apply, some maybe most probably won't. So just keep your radar up, and if it beeps, ask yourself why. Pay attention. And I should also say that this list that I'm going to start into today, and I'm going to carry on with it next week, I expect, but this list is an amalgamation of ideas. Some of these are ideas that I've been working with, I've been sharing in this setting for years. Others have come from a growing list of thoughtful folks who are troubleshooting their own religions of origin and offering their thoughts to fellow travelers. So it's a blender in that regard. And I hope that they can provide a sense that you're not going under, even as we continue to explore, you know, a deep and perhaps challenging topic. So far in this series, there have been a few ideas that I've offered as likely producing fertile ground for traumatic experiences within the context of religion. And this list builds on and makes some of those wider ideas more concise and explicit. So if you've been following along in the series, you'll recognize some of these. All of these ideas have something in common, which is that they are all meant to help us see markers of systems of belief that diminish our agency, distort our humanity, or are intended to keep us afraid. So these my intent here is that these can attenuate us to those kinds of systems. All right? So to say it another way, what these ideas all have in common is they all describe markers of systems that are toxic. I'm going to focus this on religious systems, but these ideas apply to other sorts of systems as well. So one final note before we actually get into the details. Many of the things that I'm going to suggest are very difficult, maybe even impossible. I want to be careful with, you know, full stop ideas, but super difficult to see from within the systems that contain them. A bit of a forest and trees thing. A different perspective is necessary, and providing a space where that perspective is encouraged and supported can help. And also, it's why we're here. Like, it's why the table exists, is to provide, as much as it's up to us and we're able, to provide a space where stepping outside of some of these systems might be possible, even if in a limited way. Chance to just see from another vantage point. It's what we're talking about here when we talk about room to explore what you believe. That's what that means. So here we go, exploring. First of all, and perhaps most of all, toxic religious systems are built on fear. And we've talked about some of these ideas already, particularly in their dogma shape, fear of hell, fear of divine punishment, fear of rejection, both rejection by God and by the community. And at the core of the fear of rejection of community is often the rejection of family or by family. And a frequent extension of these ideas is the fear of being, to use kind of religious language for it, outside of God's favor or displeasing to God. Don't do that. You know, that'll make God mad. And it is a fundamental shift, the first of several that we're going to note, but to consider these as toxic requires, I believe, considering the possibility that those ideas that I just mentioned and named are in fact not spiritual truths, but psychological control mechanisms, that they have come to have the shape that they have because of the end result that they produce. Now, we might jump from a sentence like that to the thought that everyone within these toxic systems is deliberately seeking to control the people within those systems. And while that might be true in some instances, I don't believe that's always the case. In fact, and some of this is just lived experience for me, in my lived experience, I think lots of people, including lots of power holders within these horrible systems, are simply teaching what they were taught. I think it's actually really quite benign for many of them. And beyond that, for the kind of the true believers from within the system, they're actually, and I've been this person, so I speak with empathy as well as with concern. They're actually, no, I am doing the right thing. I'm doing the best thing that could be done. I am teaching what saves. More on that later. But for now, the point that I want to emphasize is that, as a wise person once said to me, it's possible to be both sincere and sincerely wrong. Sincerity, good intentions, passionate belief, none of those things are the full measure of what makes something good. I mean, just take a look at any passionate but evil power holder. Like, pick one. They're not hard to find. The road of history is littered with the victims of people who were passionate about deeply destructive beliefs. And that continues to be the case today. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I'll use myself as an example of someone who can look back on their own work with people and say, I wish I could have that idea and that application of that idea back. Was I insincere when I worked with that idea? No, I wasn't. I was actually, wasn't flawless. That'd be a burden no one should have to bear. I certainly can't. But I believe I was often doing the best that I could with what I knew. I did not have ill intent, which adds to the regret, honestly, in some ways, right? You got to process that in hindsight. But it's just not hard to find. One important extension of this is that fear-based systems, including fear-based religious systems, can't actually produce liberation. They can only produce compliance. Fear doesn't free us, but it can motivate our behavior. It does motivate our behavior. Until we step outside the system, and this is a complicated thing, but I think this is fair. You have to decide, as always, but until we step outside of those systems, compliance within the system can feel like freedom, especially if we're receiving affirmation and support and we're surrounded by like-minded people. Compliance can feel like success, right? We're keeping the rules. We're doing the right thing if the system we're in is delivering the things we think we want or feel that we need. This works is the way we experience it. When I'm inside of this, it actually feels like it's delivering the things that it promises to deliver. And we can't see it otherwise from inside. Or it's very hard to. So sometimes, it's not even easy to tell we're in a system like that until we step away from it or we have an experience that somehow breaks through that systemic point of view and challenges our experience of it. All right, some of those ideas will show up in other forms as we go. The second marker that I want to point to of toxic systems is that the people who lead them often claim to have innate authority. We touched on this a couple of weeks ago when I explained why I call the talky bit the talky bit. Some of you, if you were here, you probably might not remember the talk, but you might remember the Timbit graphic. That, calling this the talky bit, is my personal, deliberate, systemic attempt to undermine that exact notion. I don't like it. I don't believe it's good. I believe it's harmful. If I can assail it in a positive way, I want to try to do that. So, talky bit. I use the word innate in what I just said, right? When I talked about innate authority. This is what innate means, as we commonly use it in English. It means existing in, belonging to, or determined by factors present in an individual from birth. We talked about that last time we talked about innate. You arrive in the world with it. There's another way to say that. And the second definition is belonging to the essential nature of something or inherent in it. Some of us might have grown up around the notion that words like pastor, priest, bishop, apostle confer divine status. They don't. I don't do that very often with language, but they don't. It's just not the way those words actually work, except inside the systems. And all you have to do to let the air out of that balloon, I say it like it should be easy, but I know that sometimes it isn't, is explore the history of those words a little bit. Language is powerful stuff. I remember the first time I was in a business meeting, this is decades ago now, and I heard somebody in that meeting identify themselves as a brand evangelist. And I think I kept it pretty sorted in the meeting, you know, but I was definitely having, at this point in my life, I was definitely having a little bit of a freak out inside because I was like, that's our word. Like, that's a, you can't be a brand evangelist because the evangelists were the guys who wrote the Gospels. Of course, the word means, you know, nothing of the kind in any exclusive sense. Christianity has been such a pervasive cultural force over the past couple of thousand years that we might think that that word evangelist always means one of the writers of the four Gospels, and it does mean that. But it also means an enthusiastic advocate. Advocate for what? Well, in the business meeting I was in, Adobe software products use the language of brand evangelists for their you know, salespeople, essentially, and their advocates, right? If that illustration feels too benign or generic, not religious enough, let's consider a word like apostle. I have not yet met a brand apostle, but maybe there's somebody out there, some marketing department. Having said that, one of my favorite bands is called Corey Henry and the Funk Apostles. But of course, That word does signify, linguistically, historically, in English, the 12 original followers of Jesus of Nazareth, as we have those stories. Intriguingly, the Bible, which would kind of be the literary intersection for that use of that word, never provides a definition for apostle. It's not in there. But, and this is the translation interpretation intersection, because when we translate, we also interpret. The Greek word that gets translated apostle in English translations in the New Testament means, in Greek, messenger or one who is sent. So, you could be an apostle for almost anything. There is no innate authority built into the term. That's contextual. And the same thing goes for words like calling or anointing or chosenness, right? Step outside of the system and it becomes visible that this is actually an exercise in institutional branding, not evidence of supernatural authority. It's about saying this person represents this inside this system. I don't know if you've ever noticed how religious institutions uncall people when they screw up. Curious, don't you think, how someone divinely called can be humanly uncalled? Or would that be recalled? Thanks, I'm here all week. Which, like I said, I amuse myself. Which leads us to a third and maybe more complex idea. So remember, we're looking for the signs of toxic systems here. So many of these ideas can also be handled in ways that are potentially life-giving, right? These are not light switch ideas. They're not either or. They're more complicated than that. The idea of what makes something sacred has long interested me. Sacred text, sacred teaching, sacred music. In terms of lived experience, my first pass at an undergrad degree was in sacred music. What is it that qualifies something as sacred? Well, in toxic systems, that word is often conflated with things that are also within those systems, sometimes called holy. So what does holy mean? Holy means dedicated or consecrated to God or to a religious purpose. All right? That's a definition. Sometimes when I look up a word, then I have to look up another word to understand the definition. So in this case, consecrated. Anybody remember the last time they used that in a sentence? Yeah. Okay, so, consecrated. To make or declare something, typically a church. Christian influence on culture and language is just showing up literal in front of us again. To make or declare something, typically a church, sacred. Dedicate formally to a religious or divine purpose. And then the second definition is to devote something exclusively to a particular purpose. So if we want to apply that second definition, we might say they had decided to consecrate all their energies to cheering only for Canadians in the Olympics. You should try that out there in wider society sometime and just see what happens. I've decided to consecrate all my energies to only cheering. Somebody's going to look at you strange. Here's the step outside of the system perspective. Communities, and when you say this stuff, it all seems so terribly obvious. Communities teach their members what to revere. What is holy in one tradition is irrelevant in another. And to follow that idea to its logical conclusion is to recognize that sacredness is not an objective property. We might more accurately call it a social inheritance, which, if you look at the space we gather in, is visible in this revolving collection of objects in the space. Are these sacred objects? Well, we get to decide that, don't we? When I was thinking about this in our context, the object that felt sort of freshest in my consideration was your eagle feather, Michael. Unless I'm looking at a feather that I find in a particular way, I'm not thinking sacred. I'm thinking that was a big bird or debris, or how did all these feathers get all over the sidewalk? They're kind of a mess. I should sweep up. Or, right? It's a perspective thing. We might look at the collection of objects on this table, for example, and not think sacred at all. We might think curious, or we might think interesting, or we might think prompt for consideration. We might think any number of things, right? It's not inherent. It's chosen. And in order to troubleshoot the potential toxicity of an idea like this, we don't have to do away with the notion of things being sacred. But we do have to take human ownership of the fact that if things are regarded as sacred, it's because we decided that was the case. We got together, social, and decided, and then passed that understanding along. Inheritance. Social inheritance. Those aren't bad things to do. We just shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that because they exist within any particular tradition, they are the only right thing to do or even the only possible thing to do, or they can't be understood another way. That's where these things get the kind of muscle that can be so easily misused. And as long as we're on the topic of how we think about the idea of sacred, let's apply that to a fourth consideration. Let's talk a little bit about sacred texts. Let's talk about texts for a moment. Because as we've noted several times over the past few weeks, one of the hallmarks of potentially harmful Christian religious systems has been, continues to be, this understanding that the collected texts that inform that religion are inerrant, infallible, fully authoritative, as well as, within those systems, the commitment to reading them literally. But here's the thing. And to make it personal, I learned this from a prof who was teaching at a fundamentalist college that I attended in my undergraduate years. He didn't last there very long, but while he was there, he was a beacon of sanity and hope for me. I felt like, I get this guy, he gets me. Neither one of us should be here. Sacred texts are not history books. The authors of those texts were not historians in the Western Eurocentric traditional sense. They were storytellers. Now, perhaps especially in the minds of those deeply influenced by Eurocentric thought, by Renaissance thought that privileges the rational, as we all are, perhaps only in sort of those in those sorts of minds would storyteller be considered a downgrade from historian, right? Let's not do that if we were able. And yet, even within those thought traditions, just the facts is increasingly being revealed as a very limited and limiting idea. Now, that is not, be careful with, stay with me here. I am not denigrating the importance of facts when I say that. I feel like facts have never been more important than they are at the moment. Having said that, we have to acknowledge, if we're being honest, that as humans, we have a limited ability to fully know and understand the facts. And at the same time, living side by side with that in our lived experience is the necessity, the importance of acknowledging the incredible power of story. In fact, even a quick pass at the evening news reveals that people believing a story, in one, even one that denies the facts, can pretty readily, it would seem, steamroll those facts. One of the best-known Nazi propagandists famously noted that if you tell a lie that is big enough and then tell it over and over, people will start to believe it. In his opinion, it helped to have it be an egregious, a really big lie, implausible initially. At a distance, that's fascinating. Up close, it's terrifying. Stories are powerful. Stories are incredibly powerful. I would argue that all cultures are built on stories, but not all cultures acknowledge that or articulate it as a high value. And sometimes this shows up, I would say, for me as a parent, one of the ways I might sort of see this reveal itself in my cultural context is I might hear myself say to one of my kids, if they are espousing a certain idea, I might have heard myself say, oh, that's just a story. Who dropped the word just in there? Where did that critter come from? Just a story? In contrast to that, I might hear myself, or we might hear ourselves teach our kids something more like, these are our stories. And they guide us in these ways. This story points to this consideration, this reflection, this teaching. And in terms of what we value, one of those things, oh, that's just a story, or these are our stories and they guide us in these ways, one of those is not like the other. Storytellers, by the nature of their craft, use myth, parable, symbolic narrative. Those are their tools. And that's what they're using to express meaning. And making and expressing meaning are central to being human. We can't help it. We have to do this, or we despair. Where this goes sideways, and what we need to learn to look out for, is when stories get read as literal history, because that way of reading them obscures their actual values, it distorts their purpose, it guts them of the best of their potential. It turns them into something they were never meant to be, which is facts. They're not facts. They're stories. All right, that was idea number four. Probably plenty for today. My original list has 14 ideas on it, and it keeps growing. We will come back to this another day. I'm not going to exhaust my list, but there's a few others that I want to highlight. So that said, I want to remind us as we go that at the center of an exploration like this, and of many of the things that we explore here at the table, is the thought that we will benefit from getting better at watching for the markers of systems of belief that diminish our agency, distort our humanity, or are intended to keep us afraid. Those are the big pieces. I'm just going to repeat those. We're learning how to watch for systems of belief that diminish our agency, that say you don't have the power, that distort our humanity, or make our humanity valuable relative to someone else's lesser humanity, that's a distortion, or that have at their intent the proliferation or nurturance of fear, that are meant to keep us in a space where we're afraid. Now, I want to say just a very quick thing about fear. Fear is not the enemy. Like, we're wired to be afraid. There's reasons to be afraid. It's one of the things that keeps us alive. When systems manipulate us to keep us in a place of fear, that's the toxicity I'm talking about, right? If we can feel fear, that just means something's working, generally speaking. If a system is trying to keep us feeling that in an ongoing way, that we're actually not made for. That's not a healthy thing. That's the toxic expression of that. So I just wanted to touch on that. For those of us who grew up around texts that sometimes captured a lot, if we take from one of those teachings the value that we can recognize truth because it sets us or makes us free, some of you will recognize the teaching of Jesus in that paraphrase, you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free, is generally the way we have that teaching. If we're familiar with an idea like that, then systems, we can take from that story, all right? Because it's the fact that it's written a certain way in an English translation doesn't mean Jesus literally ever said words like that. This is a story about an important figure in history, right? A rabbi who turned things on their head. If we take that story that sentence represents, truth sets you free, if you know it deeply, if you know it indeed, then systems that do not do that, if we're meaning-making, are not telling us the truth. So if we're encountering a system that is in fact enslaving us or others, beep, 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 enduring wisdom says that system is not telling you the truth. There might be truths stirred in there, but indeed, the word indeed in that sense takes us deeper. Go deeper. Right? Go deeper. Which in our context, I would say, to put it into our language at the table, suggests that we should keep on exploring. So let's do that. And if we know other people for whom this might have value, let's let them know that there's a place where, as much as we are able, we don't do it flawlessly, but where there's a group of people doing their best to make a space where you can do that. Peace.